Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Illustration Department podcast. My name is Giuseppe Castellano. In this podcast, I talk to folks in illustration, graphic design, publishing, animation, and other creative fields about their work, the lessons they've learned, and the bumps and bruises they've experienced along the way. In this episode, children's book historian Leonard Marcus returns to the podcast. It can be difficult for illustrators to know what lies ahead with their work and their careers, but as Leonard and I discuss, the knowledge of what lies ahead can often be found in the past. Among the topics, we talk about Leonard's book, Pictured Worlds, Masterpieces of Children's Book Art by 101 Essential Illustrators from Around the World. He and I discuss why Puffin's tampering with Roald Dahl's text opens the doors for publishers to rewrite and re-illustrate anything. And Leonard explains why we should look to illustration's history if we are to understand its future. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Thank you for wanting to do this. It's really great.
Oh, of course. Are you kidding? I very rarely say yes to requests from publicists who want their author to be on the podcast. I've made two exceptions so far, you and Sean Tan.
Oh, wow.
Plus,
I'm in good company.
Yeah, exactly. And the book in question that we're going to discuss today is about illustration history, which next to 1980s Nintendo games and cartoons is like my favorite thing to talk about. So, you know, absolutely saying yes to that. Yeah, the last time we spoke, it was the summer of 2019. You and I loosely covered roughly 150 years of American children's book history. We also debated the naming of the Caldecott. I thought Barbara Cooney was an easy layup, but you rejected it like you're some kind of perennial NBA all-star. But now here we are. A lot has happened, right?
Yeah.
COVID.
Well, No, I found that the best thing I could do was just sit at home and write all day. So it ended up being a pretty prolific time for me.
Yeah, I imagine a lot of this book was written during that time.
Yeah, the project actually started something like 12 years ago.
Really?
And a publisher named Peter Mayer, who in his earlier career had run Penguin as, you know, an international enterprise. Mm-hmm. And then after retiring from that, started a smaller company called Overlook, a publisher dedicated to the highest, you know, ideals of literature and art. Mm-hmm. Peter was also fascinated by children's books. Not every publisher of his, you know, stature is.
Right.
And he said to me that he wanted a book that, you know, really looked at the whole history of the illustrated children's book. Would I want to write it? And at first I didn't believe him. I didn't think he would want to do such an ambitious project because I knew the rights situation was going to be enormously complicated.
Yeah.
But he was, you know, true to his word. And years passed. Peter died. I'm, you know, sad to say. His company was acquired by Abrams, the great art book publisher. And they, to their credit, stuck with it. And finally, it came out.
Since we last spoke, Jerry Pinkney, Floyd Cooper, Ashley Bryan, Shirley Hughes, Leonard Kessler, Ted Lewin, Robert Quackenbush, Lois Ellert, Mitsumasa Ano, and, of course, Eric Carle were still with us.
Yes.
How have you sort of endured? I don't even know if that's the right word, but, I mean, what have you been thinking about these past few years, especially during lockdown, with respect to what's going on with the children's book industry, especially since so many of the giants seem to be leaving us?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think there always are new giants on the horizon.
Sure.
The field has become a much bigger one than it was when those people were beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they laid the groundwork for great things to come. So I don't feel like their great loss, you know, I mean, enormous loss means that they're no longer, there's no longer the possibility of special books being created.
Right.
I mean, in the case of Jerry Pinkney, I mean, for many years, he was teaching at illustrators at the University of Delaware.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm pretty sure Floyd Cooper was one of his students. Quite a few people who I know have, you know, become accomplished illustrators were his students.
Mm-hmm.
Eric Carle didn't teach illustration, but he spent a lot of time with young illustrators. And of course, he created a museum, the Eric Carle Museum of Picture Book Art, which is, a kind of flashpoint of inspiration for the whole world of people who were interested in illustration. Probably each of those people in their own way did something to, you know, provide for the future.
You know, speaking of giants and folks who sort of paved the way for the future, you also thanked your late agent, George Nicholson.
Yes.
Who passed in 2015, and you said that he sort of helped get this book. He was one of the folks who helped get this book going.
Yes. Yeah. That's right. Well, George and Peter Mayer knew each other well.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, you know, of course, very instrumental in making the contract, the arrangement for this book, so that it could become a reality. I mean, George had a really interesting career going back to the 1950s as a young English major who thought he was destined for graduate school and a job as a professor. But one of his friends in New York was the daughter of one of the creators of Golden Books. And that man, Albert Leventhal, invited George for lunch one day and said, "You don't want to be, you know, an academic. You want to go into publishing." And he talked him into it right there over the meal.
Nice.
Yeah. And the first thing George did was to work in paperback publishing, which was a new thing on the horizon. And not all of the, you know, serious publishers thought very well of paperbacks. They thought they were very down market. But George saw how it meant that books of all kinds, including great literature, could get out to a much bigger audience.
Right.
So he became very committed to that. And then later in his career, he created Dell Yearling, which was the first significant paperback line for children. And then, you know, years passed, he did all kinds of things and publishing got very big. It became less comfortable for him. And he did what a lot of senior editors have done in recent years, which is he left his job and became an agent, which allowed him to work more closely with authors and illustrators in the way editors had done in the past.
Sure. What was his connection to Judy Blume?
One of the very first paperback books that he published at Dell Yearling was actually not one, but several of the first books were books by Judy Blume, including Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. And George knew a lot about publishing history. So, you know, I loved him on two different levels. I mean, he was a great agent, and he was also a wonderful person to talk to about, you know, the history that interests me so much. And he told me that the way Judy Blume became enormously popular was after her books went into paperback. They were available in chain bookstores like B. Dalton, which were new in the early 1970s and spreading all around the country, often in the suburbs. And the people who worked at the stores, at those stores, didn't really know very much about the books they were selling. So when a preteen picked up Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, and brought it to the cash register, there was no stern gatekeeper standing there as there would have been at Scribner's bookstore on Fifth Avenue saying, "Oh, you shouldn't be reading a book like that."
Right.
And so all the kids were able to buy those books with their pocket money, get them by the cashiers in the chain stores, and tell their friends about them. And that's how Judy Blume became famous.
Well, you know, my daughters are both 12 and they are both currently reading that. So, you know, legacy continues.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, these days we're sort of in a new phase because so many of the current generation of parents grew up with her books and loved them that they're no longer, you know, the forbidden fruit that they used to be.
Right.
Very often parents will give those books to their children, whereas a generation earlier, the children had to, you know, sneak around behind their parents' back.
Right. On their way to get a pack of cigarettes and they pick up a,
pick up
a paperback. Yep. So speaking of books, the book that we're going to talk about today is called Pictured Worlds, Masterpieces of Children's Book Art by 101 Essential Illustrators from Around the World. I mean, this is so near and dear to my heart because there's so many familiar names in this book. Of course, Sendak and Company. We see some illustration department podcast guests like Ashley Bryan, Brian Collier, David McCulley, Lane Smith, David Wiesner. But there are a few not so familiar names, or rather, maybe not as familiar, like Kveta Pachovska, Mitsumasa Ano, and Elsa Besko. And they all came from the Czech Republic, Japan, and Sweden, respectively. Of the 101 illustrators that you highlighted, who would you say is the most criminally underappreciated or undercelebrated?
That's a hard question because it depends on point of view.
True.
I mean, one of the illustrators you just mentioned, Kaveta Pakowska, who I'm sorry to say died in her 90s just a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Darn it.
I mean, she was celebrated certainly in her own country, the Czech Republic, and I think was well known in Europe and probably well known in Japan, but not in the US. From that perspective, I would say she was very, very underrated. Mm-hmm. You know, if you turn the tables, you could find artists who were well known here and not known elsewhere.
Sure.
I mean, one of the curious examples for America is that, you know, after World War II, people in Japan became very interested in American picture books. Mm-hmm. It was part of the healing process and kind of returning to the fold of the, you know, the community of nations that people in Japan wanted to understand America. It was sort of formalized by the Rockefeller Foundation, which sent young Japanese men and women to libraries in the U.S. to learn about being librarians for children. And then those people brought some of the great American picture books back to Japan, where they became very well known. I mean, touchingly, at the very in the very beginning after the war, the publishing industry there had been decimated, and the only way they could experience those American books was to take a copy that had come from the U.S. and then literally paste over the English words a Japanese translation. And then women, often mothers of young children, would invite neighbors into their homes and read them to groups of local children. Mm-hmm. So it's very much of a grassroots effort to acquaint the mothers of the then young children of Japan with these great storybooks. And within a few years, the Japanese publishing industry got back on its feet and began to do its own editions. Right. And so as a result of that, some American illustrators who are represented in my book, Marie Hall Etz is one, who is such a fabulous artist, and she certainly should be much better known here than
sure.
she is now.
Yep.
And also Marcia Brown, whose work maybe I would say has faded somewhat in terms of contemporary sensibility, but she won 3 Caldecott medals. So she was very, very significant person, you know, in our illustration world.
Right.
She's today is much better known in Japan, as is Marie Hall Etz, than in the United States. Mm-hmm. So that's like one of those curious twists that I'm really fascinated by.
Sure. And Marie Hall Etz was, she and Ellen Terry created My Dog Rinty, which you and I talked about, you know,
that's
back
right.
in the previous episode, which was one of the first books that showcased Black American children in a way that wasn't disrespectful or stereotypical or even racist, you know.
That's right. And she had been a social worker, and in visiting families and getting to know the children, had noted the lack of children's books about people of color, which is why she wanted to do that.
So what would you say would be the central message of this book? You know, folks reading this book, which is, you know, some 470 plus pages after they go through this, what would be, hopefully they'll have many takeaways, but what would be one central one?
Well, I was inspired to create this book after having visited the Bologna International Children's Book Fair many times. Mm-hmm. The first time I went, which was probably 15 years ago, I was really blown away to realize how much of what is done in the children's book world is not done in the United States, and how much of it never reaches the United States. You know, here in the U.S., I think we have a big industry. It's the largest in the world. A lot of creativity has happened over the last century and more in the way of illustrated children's books in the United States. But we have tended to be somewhat insular and not all that curious about the rest of the world.
Sure.
My hope for this book, and I think my main reason for doing it, was to recognize that there's a tremendous amount of creativity going on outside the U.S. as well as within it.
Right, right. In the book, you say that a children's book is a cultural enterprise that is at once a rewarding art form, a bridge across cultures, and a ladder between generations. How so?
When I say that it's an art form, I'm saying something that the art world hasn't always recognized.
That's true.
When I became interested in this field, I noticed that one of the first things I noticed was that children's book art was almost never shown in art museums. And I wondered why that was. This was going back to the 70s and 80s. Of course, abstract art, generally speaking, was, the measure of fine art in those days, and the aesthetic of fine art. And so narrative art in general was looked down upon, but then art for children was even lower on the totem pole. I thought that's an interesting thing to question and to wonder why it happens that way. And of course, Marie Sendak, who was, the preeminent American illustrator of children's books for many, many years, often complained really about the lack of appreciation from the larger art world for the kind of work that he and his colleagues were doing. So it was really an issue as to whether children's book art, was or should be regarded as fine art or not. So that's why I felt that was worth calling out as an aspect of what this, book focuses on. It's also true that children's books tend to be handed down from generation to generation. So they're an art form that does bridge parents and their grandparents and their great grandparents in ways that almost no other art form I can think of does. Maybe so, popular songs do that.
Some TV shows, I suppose.
Yeah, and then this is a complicated issue, but a lot of children's books travel across cultures through translations and through, different foreign editions, and become a way for children of different cultures to get to know each other. I mean, this was the big dream of the International Youth Library that was created in the wake of World War II in Germany in 1949. That was meant to be repository for children's books from around the world that would draw people interested in the books from everywhere to talk about ways of sharing them across national borders. It was a kind of peacekeeping effort. A bit later, the Bologna Book Fair was established in 1964, and that became a practical mechanism for the buying and selling of foreign rights. So that was kind of the engine that was meant to drive this idealistic vision of how children's books could make the world a better place. I mean, the world is so full of war and violence that we know that it didn't work all, completely. But it certainly,
We're
has
trying.
made some difference. Yeah, and I mean, I think the current generation of editors in New York and elsewhere in the U.S. Who work with children's books are at least somewhat more open than the generations that came before to the value of bringing books from elsewhere into American children's lives. And I mean, because of globalization, American books have had no trouble getting into the lives of children everywhere else in the world for many years, for better or for worse. So there's a lot of flow back and forth, and some of it is good. I would say more often than not, it's a good thing.
I do. I like thinking of books as bridges and ladders. I'm sure you're familiar with the description of children's books as, I don't know who said this.
Actually, I had dinner with her 2 nights ago, Rudine Sims Bishop, who was a professor for many years at The Ohio State University.
Well, the mirrors thing I can understand. You're looking at a reflection of something that you're experiencing. I got that. All right. The windows thing bugs me because in any other circumstance, if you're looking through somebody's window, at best, that's creepy. At
Oh,
worst, that warrants a little jail time.
that's funny. You're reminding me of Alfred Hitchcock, Rear Window. But I mean,
That's a first.
I think what her intention is in saying that was, first of all, with mirrors. I mean, she's African American, and she was calling attention to the fact that there were so few illustrated books in the U.S. that reflected the experience of children of color. And the counterpart to that, the windows are meant not to be about voyeurism so much as getting outside of yourself and, getting to know people other than
All right.
people like yourself, and to feel some, develop empathy for them.
All right. So it's in other words, it's like you're inside your own house looking through out the window at someone else, at what other people are doing.
Right.
You're
Yeah.
still staring at them though. It's weird to me.
I mean, I think it was, believe it or not, it was Mick Jagger who said that all analogies are imperfect.
Wow. No truer words.
Right.
So I assume you're familiar with the term presentism.
Yes, I think I am.
Yeah. So for folks
Like
who,
imposing the
yeah,
values of today on the past.
exactly. Critiquing and in some cases interpreting as fact who people were and what they did in the past through the lens of modern day, let's call it morals and values, let's say. In most cases, this form of critique has stayed on pages of a book or in a blog or maybe on Twitter. But publishers are digging through their backlist and changing the very words written by authors who have long since passed. And I'm sure you know where I'm going with this. One such example is Roald Dahl.
Roald Dahl. Yes, right. Yeah, I think that's terrible.
I agree.
And to sum it up in a nutshell, it's tampering, and it's I m my feeling about, I mean, I can think of much worse examples of books from the past that contain material that we might not agree with today.
Okay.
For example, there was a couple who are represented in my book, the Dallaires, Ingrid and Edgar Perrin Dallaire. And they did a number of picture book biographies over the years, as well as collections of myths and legends. And I focused on their Norse legends book.
Right. The popular one, the one people might know them for is Abraham Lincoln, right?
Right, or their book about Greek myths and legends, which
Okay.
I think is a perennial book even today.
Gotcha.
But the Lincoln book, and also even more than the Washington book, shows George Washington's plantation slaves, happily working in the field.
Right.
That's an image that we would not ever, create today to give the impression. I mean, a picture book is a kind of telegram. Like everything is condensed, and so everything packs a tremendous amount of meaning. So a picture that shows, a picture that shows slaves grinning and having a great time picking cotton or whatever it is in the field, maybe tobacco, that is more than just an image. It's a statement meant to, tell children what slavery was like. Of course, it's not an appropriate or accurate representation.
Yep.
So what do you do with a book like that? In my opinion, you don't, go in with Photoshop and change the expressions on the slaves' faces. Maybe you choose not to have the book on your library shelf, which is not censorship. It's more like an editorial decision based on your values and your understanding of contemporary values. I
Sure.
think that's perfectly okay.
Right. Or the
Or
publisher stops publishing the book.
that's right, which again is not censorship. And it's critical judgment. And in my, in this case, I think well-informed critical judgment. But another thing you can do is you can use it for teaching. And you can say, in the 1930s and the 1940s, this is what Americans thought was acceptable to say about slavery. And today, we don't feel that way. In other words, the book itself is a part of history.
Right.
That, to me, or any of the other alternatives I've just mentioned, are better than changing the book and misrepresenting the book as it was created by its author and
Right.
illustrator.
And who knows, maybe after this recording, I'll check Puffin's Twitter or something and they'll say, never mind. Thanks for the criticism, everybody. We decided not to do it. Maybe that'll happen. I don't know. But the fact that they decided to do it and went through with it and changed things, I mean, what are we doing here? And here's the thing I want to point out. For those who are supporting this idea, let me just share a scenario that is so possible. Hold on, let me calm down here. All right. If we all normalize going back in time and changing the words of Roald Dahl and whoever else and whatever else we decide doesn't meet the current bar, The very next thing a publisher will do is use AI to what you just said. They're not going to use Photoshop. They'll train AI with all of the art, all of Quentin Blake's art. Then they'll use AI to reillustrate Quentin Blake's work.
Yeah.
That is possible.
Yeah.
All right. I'm sorry. That's my...
No, no.
Now I need to calm down.
That's fine. And I mean, I think the children's book world has for a long time talked about the classics, you know, and the timeless books.
Right.
Those concepts, you know, have their place, but they tend to kind of enshrine certain books and make them almost like holy, you know, holy relics. Mm-hmm. That's not a healthy attitude.
Agree.
We shouldn't venerate the books that we think of as, you know, the special ones. Mm-hmm. We mm-hmm. should enjoy them and get from them what we can, and learn from them what we can. That's why I think if a book ages out because of the values that are expressed by the author or the words the author has chosen to use or whatever, the book can still have a place in our education and conversation about them, mm-hmm. you know, and mm-hmm. I think people can grow from that. I mean,
sure.
Writing a book is a human experience. So is reading a book and talking about it is probably the ultimate experience you can have.
Right.
You know, an informed conversation about a book is part of the fabric of society. It's how we come together and, decide what we believe and think about things.
Yeah. Jean de Brunhoff is also in your book.
Yes.
And I think you know exactly where I'm going with this already.
But sure.
Babar came out in 1931. And mm-hmm. I think it's safe to say that Babar is sort of universally viewed as a beloved children's book character. And if you don't really know the story, so far you're with me like, yeah, Babar is super cute. But if you know the story, things change. So, you know, for folks who don't know, Babar came about when Jean's wife, Cecile, told a story to their kids, Laurent being one of them, Laurent de Brunhoff. And the story was about an elephant, and then the kids loved the story so much that so they ran over to their dad, who's an artist, and relayed the story. And Jean de Brunhoff was like, that's great. So he put together a book for his kids. His family was in publishing, so he had connections, and I think his brother-in-law was basically like, we can publish this, so they did. And then it became basically an instant hit, and it's been a hit ever since. And after Jean de Brunhoff died when he was 37, Laurent took over, in his early 20s, I think? I mean, he was a young guy when he took over, and basically up until about 2017 or whatever that was, Babar has been around for a while. But if you look at the first book, I mean, folks who criticized that first book, one person I saw said that Babar was a mascot for colonialism. Another source said that Babar was a, quote, sex criminal because he married his cousin. Another one described Babar as racist. Another one said, and pardon my language, Babar is, quote, supremely fucked up. For all those reasons, let's just use AI and change it all. Let's rewrite Babar. And if everyone's like, well, that's crazy, then why isn't it crazy to change Roald Dahl? What do you think? I need to calm down again.
Well, I mean, I chose to include the first book in the series in my book because I think it's one of the high points of the making of a picture book as a work of art.
Right. Even the lettering.
I mean, it was hand lettered. It was an unusually large book because it was about an elephant. So the format of the book matches the subject in a way that is like pure theater, you know, comic theater. I mean, Beatrix Potter was making little books for little hands about small animals.
Yep.
So you see the aesthetic of the picture book developing in the work of these two artists and other people who were thinking along the same lines. The hand lettering is so wonderful because he was thinking about how can I make this feel like it's for the child who's holding it in hand? Mm-hmm. You know, how can I make it feel intimate, mm-hmm. which is the essence of the experience of looking at a picture book between a child and adult. I mean, it's a great moment in a child's development to share a book like that
Right.
with a parent or other adult who cares about them.
Sure.
And I mean, the drawing is so elegant in the French way, and it's so funny. And I mean, the story is somewhat preposterous. It certainly makes reference to France's colonial history obliquely. A lot of people read the book and don't think about that, and it doesn't really enter into their experience of
Well,
the
'cause they're so
book.
traumatized after, what is it, the first page or two where Babar's mother gets
Oh,
shot. So,
right. Well,
spoiler alert.
this is another aspect of the book that makes it interesting.
Yeah. Agreed.
It's not a sweet little book. It's a book about life,
Yeah.
and as you say, the first thing that happens to the baby elephant, Babar, is that they're in the jungle and a hunter comes along and shoots the mother, and the mother clearly is killed, and
Yeah.
leaving Babar as an orphan who has to, in the classic fairy tale sense, has to go out into the world and fend for himself. So I don't know. I don't like to be reductive when it comes to looking at a book, and a book which is a real work of art refuses to be reduced to one thing or
Sure.
another.
Sure.
In fact, there's a wonderful quote from Edward Gorey. He said that if a book is about only one thing, it has somehow failed. So, I don't think the colonialist sort of, I don't know if even subtext is the right word, but let's say background of that book, historical background, can be ignored. But I also don't think it necessarily shapes the experience of most of the readers of that book
Sure.
in a meaningful way.
Yeah.
And there's so much to admire and love about that book as it was originally published. I mean, later editions were reduced in size. The hand lettering was changed to cold type.
Right.
It was sort of industrialized, you might say, made in more commodified, made
Yeah.
more conventional. I mean, librarians in the US sometimes complained about books that were too big or too small because they didn't fit onto their standard shelving, and publishers responded because that they were the market for these books. So, that to me, but that's part of the post-publication history of the book. And I was glad to be able to focus on how it looked at the very beginning.
Right. I have no problem being reductive. So I'm going to try to reduce the way you approached this book, the one that you've written,
Okay.
Pictured Worlds, into a neat little nutshell, and ask, in terms of like the criteria that you applied to choose these books, these moments, these sea changes, I mean, what were you looking for? And you have 10 seconds to answer. No, I'm kidding. What were the sort of boxes you needed checked to include these artists and these books into your book?
I kept it somewhat open-ended in my mind. I mean, some books do represent turning point moments, I think, in the history of the picture book. Just to sort of start with an obvious example, I mean, Marie Sendak, I think, brought the picture book into the Freudian age. And that it's not a casual suggestion because he was very steeped in Freudian psychology in his own life experience. He was acutely aware of what had come before him and the lack of emotional intensity and emotional honesty in the picture books that had come in the generations before. The kind of attitude that lets make nice for young children and let's protect them from the big bad world. And he was saying, informed in part by his knowledge of Freud, that children start with, anger and loneliness and other intense emotions. And the problem for them is not to avoid them because they already have them, it's to give them a shape and some sort of understanding. So he really shifted the project, what the picture book could offer young children on an emotional level. So that's one example. I mean, I love the sort of conjunction of Edward Lear's Book of Nonsense, which was
Mm-hmm.
from 1846 in England, and Heinrich Hoffmann's Struwelpeter or Slovenly Peter from Germany just the year before, because both books are books about outrageous humor meant for the entertainment of children. Both authors chose to publish their books anonymously because I think they were embarrassed to have done something so frivolous and lighthearted and provocative for children. They each had serious careers apart from the children those children's books,
Sure.
and they didn't want to mess up their reputations. But then the amazing thing was, remember, we're talking about the 1840s in Europe. Both of those books turned out to be sensationally popular right from the start. As
Right.
soon as that happened, they each decided to claim authorship. In Lear's case, he had trouble convincing people that he was really the author. But what's to me important about that is it captures a moment when parents and book buyers for children's books were recalibrating their ideas about what a children's book should be like. Maybe now they were saying they don't have to be teaching children something useful in the, obvious sense of that word. Maybe the point is just to make them enjoy books and give them something that they can laugh with their elders about. I mean, Lear in particular almost entirely made fun of the adult world. And in the past, that would have been considered, dangerous, teaching children to be disrespectful. But he was saying, no, children know the difference between fantasy and reality, and let them just have a good laugh and let them be in charge for once. So that was another turning point, and it set the table for Lewis Carroll, who came along 20 years later with the Alice books, which were also, outrageous in exactly the same way. Goodnight Moon, was, I think, the quintessential expression of what was learned about early childhood development in the first half of the 20th century. And it was a turning away from the main tradition of the picture book, the well-told story with a beginning, middle, and an end that would work well at library story hour. It wasn't really a story at all, and it didn't have a hero, and it only had 300 words. It was unlike any picture book that had been done before it, and yet it created a sense of well-being for children as early as 1 or 2 years old, and a ritual that would help them face the darkness, at the end of the day. And it did it, with the concision and eloquence of poetry. You asked earlier, have I seen history repeat itself in picture books? Goodnight Moon was dismissed by not all, but some of the major critics as just this sort of simple list of words. And it took a number of years before it really caught on. Then, in I guess it was the late 80s or early 90s, like probably early 90s, Mo Willems came along with the book about the pigeon driving the bus.
Right.
I, at the time, was the children's book reviewer for Parenting Magazine, which went out to 2 million people. It was the one of the only two books that my editor would told me she didn't want me to review. Apart from that, I had carte blanche, reviewed probably 3,000 books for them. But I said, "Well, why?" Well, she said, "Well, it's such a simple book, there's nothing to it." Like the librarians of the 1940s and 50s
Right.
didn't see what lay behind the simplicity.
Led by
The
Anne
play.
Carroll Moore, right? Like she was the one leading the charge against Margaret Wise Brown.
And her hand-chosen successor
Right.
and other librarians around the country who had mostly trained at the New York Public Library.
Oh yeah.
That's right.
I just wonder. I just sometimes think like, is Mark would you know before Margaret Wise Brown died at what the age of 42, another person who died young. I just imagine her at some bar talking to her friends like. Just talking shit about Anne Carroll Moore. Like she probably wouldn't do that.
Well, she did a version of it. It's on record. The library, New York Public Library, had a what they called the Pink Tea every November, and that was the event at which they announced their list of the 100 best books of the year. And it was, it was the high point of the social season in the children's book world in New York. And Margaret Weiss Brown was invited to attend one year. I think it was like 1948 or 49, which was a little bit surprising because her books were not generally admired at the library, but they knew she was an important figure. But she forgot to bring her invitation, her printed invitation. And when she got to the door, they turned her away. I mean, unbelievable. I mean, it's such hostility. So
That's amazing.
her Harper editor, Ursula Nordstrom, came along. She had her invitation,
Yep.
but in solidarity with her favorite author, she said, "Well, I'm not going in either." And so instead, the two of them went around the corner to the big stairway that leads up to the front entrance of the library. The children's entrance was on this side of the building,
Right.
and they sat on the steps. And Ursula later joked that the two of them had their own private tea on the steps of the public library. So they didn't go to a bar, but they.
Quote tea. I just can see Ursula Nordstrom like whipping out a flask. Oh my
Yeah,
gosh,
well,
that's amazing.
I'm sure either of them was capable of
Yeah, there you go.
that.
For folks listening, when it comes to, I usually end these with, asking the guest for a piece of advice, and it's usually, illustration advice, draw better, things like that. No, just kidding. But it's stuff like that. For you, I'm going to say, I mean, since you are a renowned historian, what would be one reason why people listening should pay attention to illustration history? Why they should read it? Why they should learn more about it? Heck, why they should, and I think, get your book. I mean, I think that this is the kind of book for folks who are really like, I want to get into children's publishing. Pick up this book, read all 400 and however many pages there are, and you will have such a good grip on what came before you that I think it will help you moving forward with your own illustration and writing careers. So the question to you, Leonard, is why should we be studying it?
I've been giving a lot of examples from American books, and I do want to, note that 24 artists from 24 different countries are represented in this book, and it really was. It's not an encyclopedia where you can find everything under the sun. It was definitely an effort to open people's eyes to what has been done in countries other than our own, and other than England, for that matter, which is usually thought of as the mother country to our children's literature. But what I would say, going back to Marie Sendak, since he's a familiar figure here, no one was more original in his vision for the picture book than he was in the 20th century. And I think that could be said applied to the world. I mean, his influence has been global, but no one was more knowledgeable about the history of illustration than he was either. And if you look back at his career, by the time he did Where the Wild Things Are, he had illustrated more than 50 books, most of them written by other people. Ursula Nordstrom, his editor, had put him through his paces and made a big effort to give him, different kinds of stories, projects that were not likely to allow him to get into a rut or a groove or become committed only to one way of doing things. And so he reached back to the history of illustration and to the history of art in general to be influenced and, to find material that he could make into his own. So there's no contradiction between being a student of illustration history and being an original artist. And in fact, it's one of probably the best way to fill yourself with possibilities, is to know what has come before you and then to see what you can do with that yourself. Alan Say, the Japanese American illustrator who won the Caldecott Medal for Grandfather's Journey, in an interview that I did with him once, defined imagination as rearrangement of memory. And I really love that because it brings together the idea that what we do as creative artists, which is new, is it's atoms. The molecules are coming from things that already exist, but not in the same combination and not seen through the same lens.
To learn more about Leonard, visit leonardmarcus.com. If you find value in this podcast, please consider supporting it as a patron. Become a patron by visiting patreon.com/illustrationdept. In return, you can receive our soft enamel pin, a reusable discount code for 10% off, access to dozens of patron-only episodes that we call Extra Credit, and more. This podcast is produced by the Illustration Department, a global leader in online education for illustrators. Visit illustrationdept.com for class offerings, testimonials, the alumni showcase, the podcast show notes, our forum, the bookshop, and more. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.